Fishing like a local isn't just about catching fish. It's about connecting with the environment and the people who call it home. It's about hearing the stories and traditions that have been passed down for generations and sharing unforgettable moments with the people you meet along the way. Fishing like a local is having an experience that stays with you forever. And with Fishing Booker, you can experience it too, no matter where you are. Discover your next adventure on Fishing Booker.
This upcoming concert season will be all about the boots, and Tecovas is your stop for the best in Western style. Tecovas has seasonal and limited edition offerings this spring and summer, including men's and women's boots, apparel, hats, bags, and more. All Tecovas boots are made by hand in a time-honored tradition with timeless styles that are always on trend. And Tecovas has first wear comfort with little to no break-in period. It's hard to find this level of comfort paired with this level of style. Stop by your local Tecovas store, have a complimentary drink or two, that's WCB style, and shop new styles. The smell of fresh leather and friendly staff are at your service. Many stores even have leather custom branding to make your boots truly personalized. And with regular live music and events, there's no in-store experience like it. If you can't make it into a store, just visit tecovas.com. That's T-E-C-O-V-A-S.com. They offer free shipping on all boots, as well as free returns and exchanges, and ship right to your door. Go to tecovas.com and find your new favorite pair of boots today.
Welcome back, everyone, to another episode of Feather and Fur. Your host, Brad Hurlbus, and
Dave Palmer.
Oh, boy. First real episode as co-host. Here we go.
It'll be fun, right?
It will be. And we're kicking it off good with turkey.
I think so. I think we got the perfect guest for it. I think we got someone that's pretty knowledgeable. He's definitely more knowledgeable than me about turkey stuffs. So, yeah.
Very more knowledgeable than me, seeing as we already know I don't really turkey hunt. So
that's gonna change when you come up to Ontario, buddy.
It will. That's how. Oh man, the first time I come up to birds in Canada, it's gonna be turkey, not ducks.
Ah, touche. You're not invited this year.
Well, we say we kick this off and we'll bring our guest in.
Thaddeus.
Yeah. Hi. My name's Thaddeus Blawinski. I'm a researcher and a wildlife biologist at the Canadian Wild Turkey Federation. I'm also a forest ecologist, so I've done a lot of research in the past and currently on forest management, particularly in Quebec, but focused on the boreal forest. So I'm happy to be here.
Yeah. I think it's going to be good. You've been doing a lot of research, and you kind of, every now and then, you just see a little thing and I see your name on it. And we're actually in a couple of Facebook chat groups together. And so I'm looking forward to hearing what you have to talk about. That's for sure.
Well, that's a lot for a background right there to think. Like, I've had foresters on my show before because I'm a big grouse hunter, right? And like bellwether bird, like forest management, grouse need it. Like that's where grouse thrive. So like to hear that's part of your background, and then the biology side, that's a really cool mix to like really be able to support a species.
So one of the big studies we worked on was evaluating the prevalence of West Nile virus in Eastern Canada among rough grouse and wild turkey populations. So we essentially surveyed hunters in the province. We sent out test kits. So when they harvested birds, they'd send back the blood samples, which we'd have analyzed at a laboratory in Georgia. And so that study ran for a total of 6 years. So we have 3 years of data from Ontario and Quebec, and then 3 years from New Brunswick and Nova Scotia. Unfortunately, Nova Scotia doesn't have a wild turkey season. We don't think we have any real wild turkeys in the province. Some people believe they've made it across the strait. Other people think that they're just birds that have been released from captivity. But we found from that entire 6-year period that there was a West Nile prevalence rate of 11.03%, and then 20 in rough grouse, and 26.32% in wild turkey across that entire time frame. But what's kind of notable is that the prevalence rate among rough grouse is pretty much consistent among provinces and among years. There's not too much variation. It varies maybe between 8% and 14-15%. But if we look at wild turkey, it was surprising because in both Ontario and Quebec, we'd see the highest prevalence rates ranging anywhere from the mid-30s up to 60% of birds harvested tested positive. And then in New Brunswick, 1 year there was zero, and the next year it was like 3%. So yeah, very interesting results. Now, it's a bit counterintuitive. So when people hear, you know, there's a higher prevalence rate among wild turkeys, they might assume that that means that the species is being impacted more. However, we have a counterintuitive hypothesis that wild turkey actually has a much higher resilience to the virus. So they're able to survive to be harvested, whereas rough grouse are more susceptible. And so a lot of them die before making it through to the fall hunting season. And this is supported by laboratory studies where they've inoculated wild turkeys and grouse in laboratory settings. And wild turkeys do indeed appear to show greater resilience, and rough grouse do appear to be quite susceptible.
Interesting. That makes sense then, right? Like with the numbers you just said, like it seems low in grouse, but it's because I'm assuming that just means there's just a higher mortality rate, so they're not being harvested.
Well, that's the assumption we're making. Our study, we're only analyzing birds that have been harvested, so we don't actually quantify the actual mortality that the virus has on the species. But it is interesting because, again, like I said, the rough grouse prevalence is very, very similar across all these provinces, whereas there's this huge discrepancy for wild turkey between New Brunswick and Quebec and Ontario. And I mean, the main transmission vector is mosquitoes. So we know that if the rates among rough grouse are the same in New Brunswick as they are in Ontario and Quebec, why are the prevalence rates so much lower among wild turkey? And at this point, we don't have the answer for that.
And to me, when you're talking about the transmission rate being coming from a mosquito,
yeah,
I'm thinking like you've got this huge bird with all this feathering on it. Like that was going to be my question, is like, how are they getting the West Nile? But it's mosquitoes, eh?
Yeah, that's the primary transmission vector. But I mean, turkeys do have a bald head, so.
Yeah. Oh, 100%. It just.
Yeah. No, I agree with you. But, you know, mosquitoes, they can get under clothing on humans as well. So, you know, they can make it their way between feathers. They are known to potentially target different species more than others. But again, that wouldn't play into the explanation here because we're dealing with the two same species, just with different rates depending on location.
So is the goal with this study to be able to use this for, like you see every year you get the report where it shows like, okay, this year there's this number of tags because we have a predicted number of poached animals and animals hit by vehicle and stuff like that. Like, is this going to eventually come into those calculations? Is that kind of the theory there?
No, because unlike the US, we don't face significant issues with wild turkeys and rough grouse in terms of population dynamics. So both species exhibit relatively healthy populations in our country compared to the U.S. So there have been steep declines noted in particularly in the eastern U.S. for both wild turkey and rough grouse. And there's many, many reasons. So the viruses are one of the reasons that, you know, they've attributed to this. But there's also a change in land use. There's a loss of adequate forest types. In some cases, they've even cited over-harvesting as a potential reason. In Canada, conversely, especially in eastern Canada, wild turkey populations have been booming over the last 20 years. We didn't see a single turkey in Quebec 15, 20 years ago in the Laurentians, for example. And I mean, they're everywhere now. They've even made it all the way up to the border between the boreal forest and the more temperate forest to the south. So in the Abitibi-Témiscamingue region of northwestern Quebec, they've made it up almost into the Gaspé. They've been observed in northern New Brunswick as well. So we're talking about a bird that's making significant northward expansion year to year. I mean, ruffed grouse is found across the entire country. I personally am a huge ruffed grouse hunter. In Quebec, we're lucky because we can also hunt prairie grouse and spruce grouse. And yeah, wild turkey as well. So yeah, it's, I mean, for us, it's, it seems like the future is very bright. So yeah, definitely to answer your question, this data isn't probably going to be factored into annual harvest, like quotas. In Quebec, there's no quota. Anybody can buy tags over the counter. And the amount of tags purchased has been increasing steadily year after year. I believe last year they sold around 21,000 tags with a 35% success rate. So one of the highest success rates in Canada or the US. So yeah, I don't think it'll be playing into that at all. The goal really was to establish baseline data because that was the first time anybody's run this kind of study in Canada on ruffed grouse or wild turkey. Up until this time, usually we have like volunteer reporting. So, you know, if people come across a dead bird, for example, they're asked to kind of report that to local authorities. So often you see like dead crows, other bird species that are reported. However, this, you know, because it's voluntary, usually it's people that find them in urban or suburban areas. So we're not dealing really with wild turkey or wild animal populations. We're dealing with wildlife in urban and semi-urban areas. So it really doesn't provide a good picture as to what's going on. So the purpose really is to provide like a baseline against which future prevalence rates can be evaluated to see if prevalence rates are increasing, to see if there's potentially an impact of climate change. And it could be even very useful for researchers in the United States who are also trying to get a handle on this issue where it seems to be to have more negative consequences than here in Canada.
Yeah. And those urban toms are pretty dangerous. Like you see them all the time, just attacking windows and like thinking that they're fighting another tom and it's just a reflection, right? Like,
Yeah. I mean, I've actually done quite a few interviews over the last couple of years because this is becoming a bigger issue in Quebec. I mean, historically in Quebec, ornithologists don't believe wild turkeys were ever native to the province. The first turkey was spotted, I believe, in 1976 in the province. And there was a lot of trap and transfer programs that were launched by the Ministry of Natural Resources between, I believe it was 2003 and 2006 or 8. And so that's what really led to the expansion, plus the turkeys coming across the border from Ontario and the northeastern states. So, yeah, I mean, it keeps getting better, but there have been more human wild turkey conflicts in urban and suburban areas where there are no natural predators. They're not scared of humans because they're not being hunted. And so, yeah, they display this kind of aggressive behavior, particularly during the spring breeding season. So it's a bunch of jakes, you know, these like bachelor groups that go around terrorizing the local folk, or, you know, one or two toms, you know, can potentially be dangerous. Recently, there was a, I don't know if you heard, there was a, I believe it was a jake actually that was chasing people around a town. I think it was about an hour and a half from Montreal. And the mayor actually put out a hit on that bird. And it actually ended up getting killed by a resident who shot it with a slingshot. The police were there to supervise, to make sure no one was hurt. But of course, they didn't follow the proper protocols. And so the ministry got involved because it is a protected species under provincial regulations. And it doesn't matter if the police tell you it's all right. It doesn't matter if the mayor tells you it's all right. It's not all right. So because the, you know, the province didn't authorize it. So yeah,
it Mayor, is what it is. Mayor Quimby strikes again, eh?
Yeah.
So I real quick, before we move too far on that West Nile thing,
yeah.
You see a big difference in turkeys across the different, like, is there a difference in habitat? Like you said, grouse is very, very right around that 11%. As you start to get to those variations in the turkey, are you seeing like a habitat separation between the two birds that could kind of also explain that? Or is it still very similar habitat throughout all of it? And there really isn't anything there yet, like no real good explanation.
Honestly, at this point, I don't really want to speculate because I'm not really sure what's driving it. Okay. In terms of habitat, I mean, in New Brunswick, it's predominant. It's classified as the Acadian boreal forest. So, you know, it's a mix of conifers and hardwoods. Whereas in southern Quebec, in like the hotspot of wild turkey activity, and also in Ontario, it's more of a temperate forest, predominantly dominated by broadleaf vegetation. But if we're talking about like habitat overlap, the two species occupy really the same habitats. Obviously, wild turkey, they do quite well in agricultural settings because the abundance of food. But they still require trees to roost in and the forest. So, which is where we find the ruff grouse, right? It's very, very rare that you'll see a ruff grouse in an open field. Usually they're right at the field edge or the road edges. But yeah, they rarely venture out because they're essentially at the bottom of the food chain.
Any bird of prey.
Yeah, well, that's actually one of the reasons why they flush, but only when you really get close to them, because they really want to just stay put and not be observed. Because if they do take off, they become visible to raptors that can also snag them. So really, they, like I said, they're bottom of the food chain. Everything eats them.
I honestly thought as soon as you said that you were doing the study on ruff grouse and turkeys, and I saw Brad's eyes light up, I was like, oh, let's get this. We were going to do a turkey episode. It's now a ruffed grouse episode.
No, I'm holding back. I'm staying to the West Nile and the science and both birds. I'm not letting my favorite species and my passion take over.
But yeah, I have to say, ruffed grouse and pheasant are by far my favorite birds to hunt. I love hunting wild turkey, but there's just something, I don't know if it's just the history of it. I consider upland hunting hare too, I guess, but really bird hunting, you know, pheasant, grouse, it's a very refined hunt. You know, you dress up, you go in the woods, you get to just walk a lot. I think that might be one of the more enjoyable aspects of it, where you're kind of alone with your thoughts, just taking nice walks through the woods. Hopefully you get a bird, but if you don't, it doesn't matter. You know, that I like the fast-paced action of sitting in the duck blind, but it's just not the same. Wild turkey hunting too, it's amazing getting that calling, that back and forth going. It's absolutely fantastic. But in my mind, nothing beats a nice long stroll through the woods.
Yeah. And why was it, I understand turkey because turkeys are amazing, but why was it that you chose the ruff grouse versus, like, there's all these other species that you could choose. Like, was there a reason for it? The abundance of them?
No, well, I mean, oh, you mean why did I choose them for the study?
Yeah.
Well, the study was originally launched by a colleague of mine, Dr. Amanda McDonald. So she started this when she was at the University of Guelph in Ontario. So she was the one who actually started the study in Ontario, and I joined the research team. And so I expanded that study into Quebec. And at the same time, we were able to secure funding for wild turkey. So the study actually started off for ruff grouse, but because of my implication with the Canadian Wild Turkey Federation and the funding that we had access to, we figured it would be a very good idea to assess both species. They're readily hunted. That's one of the other reasons why it's easy. This study highlights the importance of hunting, the role it plays in conservation. Because you can imagine one of the most expensive aspects of running a field study is the field work. So this kind of study, you really want to collect the most number of samples over the largest geographic area, but having more or less a homogeneous distribution of samples across that area. So you can look for trends in space and time and see if we had to pay professional hunters to go and hunt these birds individually across such a huge area, we wouldn't be able to finance it. It would be impossible to do. So hunters, essentially, they volunteer and they do it for free. So really, for us, it only costs the cost of the envelopes, the cost of the test kits, and the cost of the analysis, and that's it. So really, from start to finish, it costs about $40, I would say, per hunter at the most. That's if we go through the entire analysis. There's like two stages. They do a first test, which is relatively cheap. It's like $3 or $4 to see if they get a response, an antibody response. And then if they do, they run a second test, which is about $25. to get the full picture. So yeah, if you always assume it's going to be positive, it costs, yeah, $40 to $50 per hunter with everything included. Whereas, you know, a professional hunter would run you probably good $400 or $500 just a day, plus the cost of gas and everything else. It would be impossible.
And the professionals wouldn't be able to get you enough samples per day.
Well, you'd need a ton of them. That's the other thing, right?
Yeah. Because
you'd need them all over the place, just constantly hunting. Yeah. And they're also bound by the provincial regulations. So rough grouse wouldn't be as bad. You know, you can harvest five of them a day in Quebec, up to a limit of 15. But wild turkey, you're only allowed two per season. So unless you got special permission from the province to harvest more, it wouldn't happen.
Yeah. And yeah. You brought up a really interesting point in the fact that when people talk about like conservation efforts that hunters do, I always think like going to your CWTF dinner, your Delta dinner, whatever dinner, and like raising funds to do habitat and wetlands, and like even like bringing the turkeys back.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what you think about when you think about, but there's all kinds of other things that they do, that being one of them. So hunters do play a huge role in the conservation side of the hunt.
Absolutely.
Species, right? So
absolutely. It's a success story in North America. I think unfortunately the issue is that hunting has been portrayed in a negative light historically because number one, the commercial hunt that predated the conservation-based hunting model we have now in North America. So that's actually why species populations plummeted across North America. It was because the old model was focused on commercial hunting. Unregulated commercial hunting. So people remember that time. But the other issue is they lump in what's going on in Africa, what happened in Europe, where historically there has been an overexploitation of resources via hunting. And the situation hasn't really gotten that much better. And often the people who are implicated in these hunts in Europe and in Africa tend to be very wealthy. So already that paints the whole system in a negative light, because it seems like it's like a game for the rich, you know, to kind of just do whatever they want. And so when we really look at North America, we see it's the average Joe trying to put food on the table, you know, who have a deep, most of the time anyways, in my opinion, have a deep appreciation of nature and also have a deep understanding of nature.
And the people that are actually out there, they're passionate about it, because not a lot of people want to sit out there when there's mosquitoes and there's all that other crap. Like, so we're seeing the numbers of hunters kind of dwindling, but at the same time, the people that are still into it, they're really into it. Right. So
yeah.
And the conservation side of it is just because of that, these people are the ones that are putting in more effort for the conservation too. Right. So.
Yeah. Of course. I mean, my position at the CWTF is strictly volunteer. I don't get paid for it. I mean, we do receive some money as part of the grants to cover some of our time, but most of my time is completely volunteer-based. I don't get remunerated from it. I don't take a salary from the CWTF at all. I'm actually doing it specifically to give back because I hunt. I hunt extensively. I pretty much hunt any species I can eat that's legal to hunt, but I do want to give something back as well. I don't want to just take.
Mm-hmm. Now, is there anything
like that mentality is amazing, where you recognize the resource and you want to see it in a better place than it is because you know how valuable it is. That's really an amazing outlook to it. And I think, Dave, you're right that the more people I talk to now, the more people see the value in the resource.
Yeah. And I mean, you could take that a step further by saying that by the resource having a value, in our case, the value is that the species is there to hunt, right? And that we have biodiversity that we get to observe. So people who don't even hunt, who go into the woods just to enjoy nature for other reasons, they're giving a value to that resource. And what many people don't realize is, for example, if you outlaw hunting, if you reduce these kinds of activities that place a value on that resource, then the only people left who see value in that are timber companies, for example. And then that leads to an overexploitation. And so a good example in Europe, where they have much smaller forests that have been overexploited in the past, it's very hard for timber companies to overexploit now because there's so many groups that use the forest for other means. So hunting may not be as popular, but for example, foraging for mushrooms, plants, berries is extremely popular, particularly in Eastern Europe. And so there's a lot of groups that put that value into that resource, and that prevents other, I guess, special interest groups from taking advantage.
Mm-hmm. And the other thing that I've seen a lot lately is groups advertising, like, come out and support conservation, and they're trying to get more photographers into it, because that's becoming a big thing I've noticed too, is you're seeing a lot more wildlife photographers and stuff like that too. And there's been some beautiful pictures of turkeys coming out lately, right?
Oh yeah.
Yeah. So I guess the next part we should talk about is the actual hunting of turkeys.
Well, maybe before we jump to that, there's a little bit more research that I'm currently working on that you might find interesting. So the West Nile study that we did, the last 2 years that we did of the study was funded by the New Brunswick Wildlife Trust Fund. So that's a government-sponsored organization in New Brunswick that hands out grants for conservation-based research. It could be for wildlife, it could be for remediation, restoration, cleanups of rivers or forests, that kind of stuff. So they financed 2 years in New Brunswick, and we just last year got a grant because we got into a project with the government of New Brunswick, the Ministry of Natural Resources and Energy Development. And as part of that project, what we're doing is working on implementing a fall brood survey, which we launched this past year, which was highly successful in the province. And also we're further refining their existing hunter survey. So, you know, I don't know if you guys are familiar with them. I think you are in Ontario. Essentially, when you finish up with your spring turkey hunting season, you're supposed to respond to a questionnaire on how your hunt went. You know, how did the populations of wild turkeys seem to you compared to other years? You know, did your hunt go well? How long did it take you to harvest a bird? That kind of stuff. And so what we're doing is looking at the surveys that are being implemented in other jurisdictions and other provinces and states, and trying to, I wouldn't say necessarily improve it, but add relevant questions that we think could bolster the analysis that the government does using that data after. And then the final thing we're working on is a nuisance bird reporting survey. So essentially the people who have problems with wild turkeys, for example, farmers who perceive that they're causing damage to their crops or whatnot, they can use this the survey as a means of reporting this issue to the government, which in turn can either evaluate what the issue is and see if there's a way of mitigating it or solving it. And also it gives them an idea of the impacts that wild turkeys are having in the province. Because again, this is relatively new, right? They just launched the hunt a few years ago. There weren't any turkeys in the province before then. Populations are increasing a lot. So of course, you know, you get some unintended consequences, right? And so by improving the wild turkey population assessment strategy, we're better able to assess population dynamics in space and time. And that would actually tie into how many tags become available.
And how do you mean you're trying to update the questions asked? Because I think it's the deer one was it the turkey one where they say, like, how many birds have you seen, right?
Yeah.
Yeah,
well, those are standard questions. So the current survey they have pretty much has that. It's like, how many, you know, how many males and females did you observe, for example? How many days did it take you to harvest your turkey? So those are quite standard questions. But then there's other questions that a lot of people wouldn't even consider as important, but they are quite relevant. So like asking, for example, what are the obstacles? Would you consider the main obstacles for you to be able to turkey hunt? Is it a lack of access to land? Is it a lack of understanding about the methods and tools? So by including such questions, you're not only providing quantitative data on numbers of turkeys, you're also providing qualitative data that allows the government then to see, well, how can we, for example, generate more interest in the hunt? How can we get a better hunt offered? What are the resources we can use to improve not only hunting, but improve wild turkey numbers and manage them sustainably.
The one question that always got me was the, how many birds did you see? And I'd fill it out. Like say I only took my son out four times and I saw 15 birds. I'd put 15 birds. Well, then my son went out with me every single day because he can't legally hunt without me when he's too young. Right. How many birds did you see? Well, the same number as my dad, but is it skewing the number because we both saw the same 15 birds at the same time? Like that. Yeah. I thought you were getting more into like more detail about the, what you were observing, but hearing that it's going to be quantitative and qualitative in the fact that you're going to be using it to see if we can get more people interested in it is, it's a different aspect that I didn't think about. So that's pretty neat.
Yeah, but and I mean also because I don't know, I actually emailed the biologist in Ontario to get a copy of the survey, so I'm not sure what the questions are. But in Quebec, they ask specific questions on. So it's not just how many turkeys did you see; it's also how many toms did you see, how many jakes did you see, how many females did you see. So it actually dives deeper into the specific numbers and breakdown how many unknowns. So for people who aren't able to classify them. And so, yeah, this is quantitative data, but it's not like you're saying, you know, there could be many people seeing the same birds. You could be seeing the same birds from day to day. So it's not like it's going to provide a dead accurate number. But when you combine that data with the number of tags sold, with the number, the success rate, with the brood survey, which gives you an idea of how many, the recruitment, you know, the success of the brood rearing period, how many chicks actually, you know, were made it through to survive. So you have, you know, part of that survey, you ask questions like, well, when you see a group of turkeys, and we did this in the month of August and September, we ask, for example, how many toms did you see? How many jakes did you see? How many hens did you see? How many poults did you see? And so by getting that, so then we have those numbers specifically. And yeah, we have repeat data, but there's a question in there that says, have you observed these turkeys before? And that way we can also kind of segregate the data by knowing that certain observations have been the same birds over and over again. Mm-hmm. But that data is crucial because it tells us, for example, what the male to female sex ratios are, which is important. It tells us how many poults there are per hen or per group of birds. So that tells us about the reproductive success of that year. Because if we see that there's a lot of poults, that means chances are there's going to be a lot of birds the next year. Of course, it depends on how severe the winter is, but it gives you a pretty good idea. There's also another question, for example, the size. So in relation to the hen, what is the average size of the poults that you observed? And so we have classes like 1/4, 1/2, 3/4 the size, or the same size. So it makes it easier, right? Because hens tend to be roughly the same size. Adult hens, there's not too much variation. And so by comparing the poult size to the hen size, that gives us an idea, for example, of how late in the season they hatched. Because if they're only a quarter or half the size of the hen in September, that means that chances are they came from maybe a second clutch of eggs, or, you know, where the first one failed, or the bird had a second clutch. And that gives us an idea of what the chances are also of them surviving the winter. Because, of course, the larger the turkeys, come winter, the better their odds of survival. So there's a lot of information that can be gained from each of these surveys independently. But when you put them together, you end up with this comprehensive assessment strategy that really goes a long way to give you a good estimate of the overall population size.
Man, thinking back to my first couple of years turkey hunting, that survey that you're talking about would just add insult to injury. Like, how many days did you hunt? 10. How many birds did you harvest? 0. How many toms did you see? 1. How many jakes? 5. But they wouldn't come close enough. Like, yeah, just the one tom. Yeah.
Do you find you're getting like one thing I've heard from, I've seen it on social media. I've heard other hunters say it, like, don't give accurate information because it's going to, we don't want this many more tags. Like, we don't want it to be over harvested. And there's concerns there that if they say they see hundreds of birds a day, and I know I'm exaggerating, I'm just throwing large numbers, but if we report all the birds we see, they're just going to increase the tags and we're not going to have birds in 2 years.
Well, I mean, look, as someone who runs these studies, I would really appreciate if people were honest about it, because you know, there are different management objectives. So these populations are trying to be sustainably managed. We know that there's carrying capacities. We know that there could be negative impacts if populations exceed carrying capacities or become too numerous. So this whole idea that they're either going to, you know, close the hunting season because there's not enough birds, or they're going to put out too many tags because there's too many birds. I mean, you know, I don't see too many issues. Look, if there's not many birds and they close the hunting season, they're doing it because they want the population to rebound so that you're going to have a sustainable hunt in the future. So people complaining that, you know, they're going to cancel the season. Well, yeah, okay. So you're going to have to deal with that short term. But in the long term, you're going to have a viable population that you can harvest, your kids can harvest. So really, I almost see that as a little bit selfish, because they're really...
I agree. It is selfish.
Selfish. And they're also skewing data, which again, it doesn't help, because our job is to try to be as objective as possible and to compile empirical data that we can use to essentially determine how to manage these populations. So if people are foraging the data, that just makes our job more difficult.
And I want to be like, when I say selfish, it's selfish for the moment, right? Because they don't want the hunting to change, right? I'm not saying they're necessary, but they're not looking at that bigger picture of, if the population is struggling, like, we want it to be sustainable. There's also the very real issue of overpopulation and disease and everything else that can come with it.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, I mean, I think I would agree with you that I think a certain proportion are selfish in the sense that it's like short term, but there are people also, look, there's a lot of people who poach. There's a lot of people who do have questionable ethics when it comes to hunting, unfortunately. They do, in my opinion, make up a very small minority, but they're still there. So I think some people, yeah, they're just looking out for their own interests. They just want to keep hunting the birds or the big game, regardless of the long-term consequences, because they want that gratification in the moment. Whereas, you know, hunting, it takes a lot of patience. That's one thing we learn as hunters, right? You got to be patient. And we got to apply that also to the long-term sustainable management of a species. We have to be patient. If the species isn't doing well, it's not going to help to forge the numbers to make it seem like it's doing fine, because then eventually those numbers will plummet and we'll have a problem.
One big suggestion I could make is a reminder when you purchase your tag to keep track of the amount of birds you see, or whatever the questions are, because every year, like, and I might even be mixing up the turkey with the deer tag thing on how many you see or whatever, but like, you come up, you fill it out, and then it's like, how many birds did you see? I'm like, well, shit, I can't remember. Like, I never even thought to keep track of that, right? Like, so if they remind me, you know what I mean? Like,
Unfortunately, I think I get too much good luck with wild turkey hunting, because I hunt for 1 or 2 days. I tag out. So it's very easy for me to remember how many birds I see.
You're saying that, and I'm thinking of like a Borat quote, like, king of the castle, king of the castle.
That's right. Very nice.
Yeah. So no, that's, yeah. It's interesting to hear the aspect of how much that survey actually can help, right?
Absolutely.
In both, and being honest about it, as honest as you can be, right? As good as you can remember. And yeah, it was a good point that Brad brought up, like, underpopulation and overpopulation are both things that have to be looked at, right? So
yeah, and I mean, look, at the end of the day, the government, the agencies responsible for management, you know, they're aware that people do lie on these surveys, and it's not like that's the only metric we have to assess population. So biologists do actually send out technicians into the field, for example, to just drive around in the early mornings and try to evaluate how many birds they see. There's other methods they use, but when it comes to populations, like for bird species, for example, they're not easy to observe. You know, they're small, relatively small animals. They only come out really to be easily observable at certain times of the days. I mean, wild turkey, especially in the fields, you pretty much see them early morning, within the first 2 hours of daylight, and then in the late evening, and they sporadically emerge during the course of the day, but they spend a lot of time in the woods. See, moose surveys are done a bit differently. So the government, actually in Quebec, they do helicopter surveys, and they'll actually fly over and count the number of moose that they can see, because it's a very large animal. They're quite easily visible, particularly in the wintertime when there's snow cover on the ground. So that's often when they do such surveys, and sometimes they evaluate you know, in more detail individuals, so they'll actually tranquilize some of them and land the helicopter and go out and take measurements, take blood samples, and then, you know, release the animal. So yeah, the different methods, they vary between species, and, you know, some are more, I guess they give you more information than others. But that's why having a strategy in place that uses a lot of different metrics is the best strategy, because it gives you the biggest picture possible.
Mm-hmm. And the changing dynamics. I did a talk once with a guy that was doing survey, or he was doing work on ducks, and the fact that, like, the bred ducks are breeding with the actual normal ducks, and the percentages and all that stuff. And they were finding, when they were doing the surveys, they'd fly the plane over in the specific pattern every year, but they weren't getting a big population of it, because these ducks that were being bred were coming in closer to the urban areas that weren't being part of the study anymore. So right. They're having to make changes for that. So it's kind of neat that having the different variety of it is good there too.
Right. No, exactly. Now, one thing I thought maybe is kind of important to mention while we're still on the subject of wild turkey research, the mortality of wild turkey in Canada, the main mortality agents are winter. So thick snowfalls and extreme temperatures, particularly large variations in temperatures, because these birds, you know, they ideally forage for their food on the ground. So if they have very, very thick snow cover, they're not able to you know, ingest as much food as they can, which makes it hard to regulate their body temperature. And then when you combine and energy as well, and then when you combine that with periods of extreme freezing temperatures, then you can end up with very, very high mortality rates. Also, when you have, for example, a spike, so you have a lot of snowfall, you have a spike in temperature where it goes up and you have rain, and then overnight it just drops down to like minus 20, minus 30 degrees Celsius for you, Brad. it could end up with quite a high mortality rate. So at the northern limit of the species population, that's the main limiting factor. So this isn't something necessarily that is as important in large parts of the U.S., perhaps towards the central areas or the mountain regions in the west. But on the East Coast, where temperatures are more mild, those wouldn't be the main limiting factors. I know in the springtime, the amount of rain we get is important as well, because, again, there's an understanding that when you have lots of rain, predators are actually better able to smell the turkeys on the ground, so they can find the nest. They can actually follow the hens back to their nests. And also the chicks have a much harder time when they hatch when there's a lot of rain, because they're wet, they're not able to fly as quickly, they're not able to regulate their temperature as well. So that can engender high mortality as well. A very good example of the winter effect, actually, was I personally observed it in my hunting area last spring. So the year before, because of the two instances of chronic wasting disease that were observed in Quebec, only about 15 or 20 kilometers from my cottage, it was in a deer farm. So it wasn't in the wild population, but essentially where the fences were, you'd have the deer inside the fences, and then you could have deer from the outside just coming right up to them. So there was a possibility of transmitting that disease. And so the ministry, to minimize the chance of transmitting chronic wasting disease, they outlawed baiting deer outside of deer season in the province. So before, you know, people would put out food for deer year round, and of course other animals would profit. So often it's corn, right? So you'd get grouse, you'd get turkey coming in to feed on it. And so in my particular neck of the woods, there was actually a guy who had a bed and breakfast, and he would keep piling corn out all winter to have the deer and the turkeys come in so that his guests could observe them from their rooms. And so the population locally expanded because they had a lot of food, So there was a lot of birds hatching. And all of a sudden, that year, that in the fall, when it became illegal, he stopped feeding them. That winter, we had heavy snowfall and a period of about 2 weeks where we had temperatures between minus 20 and minus 40 degrees Celsius in the night.
And for you, Brad, that's really friggin' cold.
Yeah. And
it gets cold in Wisconsin. Remember, it does get cold in Wisconsin.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, that's I'm sure you guys have temperatures like that in Wisconsin. But, yeah, essentially it went from the previous year having 30 toms on my property and the adjacent properties down to me spotting maybe four last spring. So last spring was actually a hard hunt for me. I shot one bird on opening day, and then I shot my last one at 10:30 on the last day of the season. We can only hunt till noon in Quebec, so it was really down to the wire. But yeah, no, the population there locally just crashed because the food source was gone. They were habituated to it. And they, you know, they weren't habituating to finding as much food in the wild because it was just put out for them. There was a lot of birds. And so, yeah, we lost a ton of birds as a result.
So, quick side note, negative 40 Celsius and Fahrenheit's the same. So that one's a very easy one for me to figure out. But, like, do turkeys...
Is it really?
Yeah, it is, actually.
I didn't even... Yeah.
Do turkeys need a certain amount of... Like, will turkeys snow roost? Like, when it gets really cold, will they roost in snow at all? Or do they still roost only in trees?
That's actually a really good question. I don't know, because I know rough grouse do it.
Right. So that's why I'm curious, like, is a certain amount of snow cover a good thing when those temperatures drop? Because for grouse, it is. I know that for grouse, because they'll bury in the snow and they'll regulate their body temperatures in their little snow caves. I just don't know if are turkeys too big for that.
I mean, obviously, if they did do it, they would require much deeper snowpack than rough grouse. But also, rough grouse don't need a lot of snow to cover. You know, a couple of feet will do the job. And you have to understand that, you know, especially in the forest, because of wind breaks, there could be areas, if you only have a couple of feet of snow on the ground, you could have areas that have no snow at all. So they still and grouse can, you know, forage for berries and plenty of other things up in the trees, which is not as easy for wild turkeys to do. So it's not, if they do indeed do it, I don't see that as being beneficial, having more snow just to be able to survive the cold temperatures, because it's still limits the amount of food they have. So when they have to emerge from that snowpack, they wouldn't have enough food to make it through.
That makes sense, that the snowpack would have to be so deep in order for them to utilize it for any sort of roosting capabilities. It would just hinder all their food source.
Yeah, but I honestly don't think they do it. I've never observed it myself. I've actually seen grouse do it. I found the little holes they go in. You can see like a little hole at the surface. Mm-hmm. Sometimes if there's no snow, you'll even find the areas where they bury themselves. Actually, that's one of the ways I hunt them in the wintertime. I just follow their tracks. I go out early in the morning, and 9 out of 10 times you follow a track and you'll find a grouse at the end of it.
Wow. So I don't want to get into climate change or any of that stuff, but we're seeing milder winters, right? And
yeah.
Right now, like last week, I was sitting at my office at work and there were toms strutting. It almost seemed like a better example would be ducks. Like, because the winter was kind of coming in, didn't come in as early as normal. It came in later. The birds that I wanted to see didn't really show up until season was over pretty much. Right. For the ducks,
but right.
The toms, and it almost seems like maybe they're starting to come into a little bit earlier. Is that something that's looked at all?
You mean when they start breeding?
Well, they're strutting and right now out of my office, and normally you don't even hear them in the bush. I guess it's April now, but like it just seemed like they were kind of coming out and we're seeing the birds earlier.
Well, I mean, I have reports. So some of my buddies in Quebec, they saw toms strutting in Quebec in February.
Yeah. And you're seeing them earlier and earlier. Is that something that's...
Yeah, because there's two things, two main things that drive the spring breeding season, and it's a photo period, so the amount of daylight and temperature as well. It's similar to like when trees when it's the bud break in trees, so obviously they can't just use temperature, because you could have, you know, periods of very warm temperatures in the late winter, for example, where if they start budding they're going to die once the temperatures plummet again. So it's a combination of the two. It's the length of daylight and the temperatures that really drive that behavior.
Yeah. And I guess that was my crappy question asking way of getting you to say that.
No, but climate change, it's a reality. I do a lot of my research in forest management is actually centered around climate change, because it's I look at fire cycles in the boreal forest and forest regeneration and productivity, and so how the forest is going to evolve over the next 100 years, for example, and what implications that has for forest management and our ability to sustain the industry in the province. I'm a firm believer in climate change. Look, when I was a kid growing up in Montreal, when I was, you know, young, under 10, every winter was a white Christmas. And now, if we have a white Christmas, it's like a bonus. It's a very big rarity. I think in Montreal, we've had a white Christmas the last, 2-3 years out of the last 10. So, yeah. I mean, it's more typical now to get rain on Christmas than it is snow.
Yeah. I work shift, and I can remember 2014, 2013, getting storm stayed at work for like 50, 60 hours, 3 or 4 times, right? And now it's like barely happens, which is...
Yeah.
Yeah, things are definitely changing there. You talk about fire, boreal forest fire and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
There was a TikTok that was sent out to me recently, and it was a guy saying, if you want to get turkeys, find an open patch of grass, burn the grass down, and the turkeys will show up within a week. And I'm not saying that that's true, but I didn't like it from the fact that I didn't want to see people going out and starting to burn freaking grass, and you know what I mean? But
no, but that is a strategy that they use. They use controlled burns in the US to improve wild turkey populations and other species as well. I can't remember the states. It's in the Southeast though. Might be in the Carolinas around that region. That's in the pine forests. That's what they do.
Yeah. And you see it too, like when you probably know better studying forestry, but like when forest fires happen, the burnt area, like animals start coming back sooner than you would expect.
It's actually because I've conducted years and years of research in immediately following fires, so getting into fires within 2 weeks after all the way to years, decades after, and looking at how the forest regenerates. And even 2 weeks after a fire burns, you've already got basil sprouting from the bottom of trees, like birch. You've got ferns coming out. You have mushrooms coming out. You have the pyrophilic insects and bird species that come in. Pyrophilic means these bird species and insects that rely on fire to complete all or part of their life cycle. These fires are actually necessary for the forest. And so one of the reasons why white pine and red oak ecosystems have declined across North America is because of a lack of fire. So fire suppression has actually it's led to the, we refer to as mesification of the forest. So forests that are typically dry that have periodic low intensity surface fires, because of fire suppression, they don't burn out the fuel. They don't allow the trees that are there to keep dominating. And so it leads to a transition into a new forest type over time of species that are more adapted to close crown conditions, low light conditions, more humid conditions. Conversely, in the boreal forest, the forest is adapted to stand replacing high intensity crown fires. And there are species like jack pine that actually require fire to regenerate. So they have very, very hard cones on the branches. And when the fire burns through, it actually opens up the cones. The fire reduces the organic layers. It exposes better seed beds. The cones open up and the seeds fall and they regenerate the forest. It's called the self-replacement hypothesis. So essentially under normal fire conditions, the forest that existed before the disturbance will reemerge after the disturbance, and it won't allow other species to take over. And so that's one of the reasons why the two main conifer species in the boreal forest are black spruce and jack pine, and the main hardwoods are aspen and birch.
As a firefighter, I'm not saying go do a controlled burn.
We use a lot of controlled burns here. It's actually one of the ways like Pheasants Forever around here actually makes money. They help with habitat management through controlled burns. Like they'll go out there and do it, and they'll charge a private landowner a reasonable amount for it, but it's a way to bring money in to help sustain their management, right? But controlled burns are used quite a bit here by the Wisconsin DNR in public marshes and on public lands to control invasive species for habitat regeneration. It's a very commonly used tool for us.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And in a lot of the research I was doing, we were looking at ways to reestablish these declining red oak and white pine ecosystems. And that's one of the main ways to do it, is to use prescribed fire, to use selective harvesting methods that emulate fire. It's the ecosystem-based forest management strategy. That's what it's based on. It's emulating natural disturbance in forest management to essentially try to recreate the same conditions that are produced by a wildfire to make harvesting more sustainable. Now, of course, it doesn't actually achieve that target because fire has a whole other bunch of effects that forest management just can't emulate, but they are trying to be as close to it as possible.
Wow. And we are at 55 minutes and we haven't even talked once about hunting turkeys. Wow.
Beyond informative. Like I've learned so much when it comes to I was really hoping when I'm like, I really want to pick his brain on West Nile. Like that was one topic I wanted to talk about because I knew for me, it's a cross thing, right? Because I'm a grouse hunter, right? And I didn't know you were, but I knew you were a turkey. I knew you were turkey biology. I'm like, curious to know his thoughts on West Nile and all, and to hear you did all these studies and where we all super informative.
Yeah. The one thing I was thinking is we talk about deer with chronic waste disease and all these other diseases, and if they have it, don't eat it and all that stuff. And ducks, rice breast, can you eat it? Can you not? And now we're talking about West Nile and turkeys and stuff. And it's oh man, do you eat them? And we've probably, especially with the numbers being 30%, we've probably been eating them and not even known West Nile existed in the turkeys until we were talking here today. Right. That's the one thing that kind of wow.
Well, look, you're in Ontario. I have the table in front of me. So in Ontario, hold on. Let me see if I can find it. So spring 2019, we had a prevalence rate of 61% in Ontario. Spring of 2020, it was 36%. Spring of 2021, it was 32%. So if you hunt turkeys, there's a good chance that you've eaten one that's been infected with West Nile. But there's no reason not to. We do suggest that people wear gloves when they, clean their birds and cook them properly to well done, like all pretty much fowl except waterfowl, which can be eaten pretty much raw. I know these things. I don't wear gloves. The risk is so low.
Just wash your hands really good after.
Yeah, well, like when you handle any meat, right? It doesn't really matter. It's just basic hygiene, right? So as long as you keep that, because chances are if you're gonna lick your fingers or whatever, ingest anything because you're manipulating a bird, chances are you're gonna get sick from something else, not the virus. It's just the fact that there could be bacteria on the bird or whatnot that would cause an illness. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I wouldn't worry about West Nile virus at all in terms of transmitting it to yourself while cleaning a bird.
Good.
Yeah, chronic wasting disease, that's a whole nother ball game. It hasn't made the jump from wildlife to humans yet, but that is the fear that it is possible. And it's a horrible disease. So if it ever does make that jump, it's going to be quite scary. But when it comes to rice breast, stuff like that, those are just larvae, right? Yeah. It's just protein.
Would you eat a duck that had rice breast?
I'd probably cook it well done, but yeah, I'd eat it.
Yeah. So,
yeah. I mean, it doesn't bother me.
Yeah.
I don't eat it. Well done. That's all.
Yeah.
Chronic wasting has been in Wisconsin for a long time. I know it's been a hotbed here for a long time. a lot of other states I know in the U.S. has based their research on what to do and what not to do. Like Wisconsin's made a lot of mistakes, but we were hit hard. We were when there wasn't a ton of research being done. With all that said, like we have ways to have our deer tested here. Like there's like sample stations and chronic wasting disease stations and all of this. I won't eat the organs. Like I'm not an organ eater. Like you'd never see me eating organs from a deer, but I don't get mine tested. Like I cook my meat right. I handle it right. And
the problem is that chronic wasting disease. It's the prion disease. The only way to actually destroy it is incinerating it over 500 degrees Celsius. So you cooking it to well done will not kill it if it's in it.
Sure.
It just won't. You literally, I believe it requires a sustained temperature of over 500 degrees Celsius, and you're cooking your meat let's say medium rare, what, 130 degrees Fahrenheit?
Right. I knew it wouldn't kill, like, right. Because that's one of the issues with, like, when it gets into the ground, right? Like, with what they talk about.
And it lasts for years and years. The proteins can survive for a decade on the ground, in water. So, yeah, it's definitely something to think about. Luckily, I mean, in Quebec, like I said, we've only had two cases, and it was both on the same farm. The province had like a cull after that. They hired professional hunters around that farm to kill a lot of the animals. But at the same time, they opened the season that year. So typically in Quebec, we have like an archery season that runs late September for like 2.5 weeks, 3 weeks, followed by a pause of about 3 weeks, and then a rifle season for another 2 weeks. For that year, they essentially opened up the season 2 weeks early. They kept it open all the way through to mid-November, so no breaks, and they allowed you to harvest any deer. There was no exception, so you can harvest male, female, you could harvest a fawn even. Unfortunately, people did it. I mean, they were bringing dog-sized deer to the registration stations. But you could also use any kind of hunting equipment that you want. So you could use a rifle during archery season. They didn't decimate the population, but they harvested a tremendous amount, and they didn't find a single animal in the wild that was harvested that tested positive. So that was that cull that they instituted was that first year following the discovery. But then they've been doing the sampling for chronic wasting disease now since that was first discovered. I believe it was 4 or 5 years ago. They've been doing that every year within that zone. So there's a specific zone around, I forget what the radius is. I think it's a 50 kilometer radius around that farm. And anyone who harvests a deer within that zone has to bring it to a registration station where they will take the samples. They can only bring their meat to a butcher within that zone. So they can't actually bring it to a butcher outside that zone. And the butcher cannot process the meat until you get a result back, a negative result from the government, at which point you inform them, you provide them with the proof, and they proceed with butchering your animal.
We have similar here, not for chronic wasting, because it's just more prevalent than that, but we have tuberculosis areas. Whereas if it's found in cattle, they put very big restrictions on deer in that area where the deer have to get sampled and thing very similar to what you're doing, but for that reason.
Right. Mind you, I mean, I try to eat as much of what I harvest as possible. So, I mean, some people are squeamish when they hear what I eat off of a deer. I save everything. I'll take the cull fat. I'll take the testicles, the tongue, pretty much anything, the liver, the heart. Yeah, I'll eat it all.
I know people that do as well. I stay away from organs. And if that in the back of my head somehow, I feel like that's better with chronic wasting around here. It probably isn't, but to me, I just tell myself that.
Yeah, well, my parents are Eastern European, so I grew up eating like tongue and stuff like that. So for me, I mean, I find it absolutely phenomenal. Have you ever harvested the cull fat off a deer?
I have.
Yeah, see, that stuff's amazing. When you wrap meatloaf or meatballs in cull fat, it just renders around them and keeps them moist. It's absolutely insane.
And you eat the cull fat?
Like, yeah, you essentially, it's like a very thin lining of fat, And yep. so you when you make meatballs, you literally just wrap it in the caul fat, just one thin layer. And then you bake them like that, and that fat just renders around it, and all the moisture within the meatball stays there because it doesn't dry out, right?
Yeah.
It acts as a layer.
Yeah. I was thinking of I can't think of the name of the meal, but like you take the corn husk and you put the food in it and you cook it in inside the corn, like the wrapping on the corn, and then you take the meat out of it and you eat it that way.
Yeah.
So I wasn't sure if that's what you were doing with it or not. I'm not a deer hunter.
No. In my case, I literally just wrap the actual meat with the caul fat. But I mean, there's other, like in Hawaii, they wrap the pig that they they heat up lava rocks.
Yeah.
And they throw them into a pit that they dig out on the beach. And then they wrap the pig in banana leaves. And then they throw that in there and bury it for like a whole day. Yeah. And it just cooks slowly. And it's absolutely incredible.
There's a place near here that every year they have a big party and they do that. And they order like certain traditional, I don't know where they're from, but they order certain traditional like cuts of meat and they mm-hmm. cook it that way. And they dig it all up and then everyone feasts on it. And it's pretty neat to see. And it's freaking delicious too.
Yeah.
I have one question. Did they change the rules for the deer farms by you? Like, does it now have to have like a double fence? And is there like, did they change any of those regulations around your deer farms?
That I'm not sure about. No, I didn't look too much into that.
Sure. Just curious.
Yeah. I mean, that would seem like a reasonable thing to do, right? To at least maintain a distance, social distancing for the deer.
Right.
Yeah. That's a lot of information in one hour.
If you want to get into turkey hunting, I don't mind.
Yeah. do you want to do turkey hunting too? You good for that, Brad, or do you want to do another episode on turkey hunting?
I almost feel like we should split this one up. That's a lot of information for people to take in an hour. And I know just from our conversation already and your knowledge, like to know what you could add to the actual turkey hunting side of this, I'd hate for people to be like starting to tune out and not really ingest that.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Cause I have some really great tips.
Yeah.
Particularly on dealing with hung up birds. That's one thing that a lot of hunters complain about. And yeah, there's numerous strategies to kind of work around that. They don't always work, but when they do, it feels damn good.
Okay.
See right there. There's the teaser to bring everyone back.
Yeah. And that means you too.
Oh yeah. Yeah. No problem.
Good. I think the biggest thing we have to do is like, you're still doing this research this year, right?
For the wild turkey assessment surveys. Yes. Okay. The West Nile study we wrapped up. So we're not continuing that on an annual basis. Hopefully, other researchers will continue, not necessarily for the same species, but we'd like to see more of that research being done.
Yeah, because I was going to say, like, how do you get, if there's anything that people need to send in or stuff, this would be a great time to say it, but yeah.
Yeah, unfortunately, no, at the moment, that's not on our agenda.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good.
But we do, one thing I do ask is if people are interested to try to get involved with their local CWTF chapter. If they don't turkey hunt, then support other not-for-profit conservation organizations, Ducks Unlimited, Delta Waterfowl. All these organizations play a vital role in conservation. They generate a lot of money. They generate a lot of community benefits. I know for a fact the CWTF has a lot of outreach programs for women and children. We run turkey hunting camps. We call it the Youth Hoot and Shoot. We have them in New Brunswick. We have them in Maine. We have them in Ontario, where we get children out with a mentor who are just of legal age to hunt, to go out and harvest a bird. You know, they do a whole turkey seminar with experts, and then they learn how to pattern their gun. They go out and they learn how to roost birds. These kinds of initiatives go a long way, not only to conserving species, but also generating interest for the next generation of hunters.
And then do you also help with the, like, help, like, from your forestry background and your biology background and that, do you also help plan with the, like, help plan the local province with the provinces and that to help put them, put together a sustainable forest plan?
Well, it's funny that you ask. Actually, that's one of the things I'm working on right now through one of the, well, through the, my main job. I'm working with the government of Quebec, looking at integrating natural disturbance in their calculation of annual allowable cut, and also providing different silvicultural strategies that could be employed to adapt to or mitigate the effects of climate change, particularly in the context of natural disturbance. So, you know, how do we manage forests to essentially maintain a sustainable supply of wood over time and maintain productivity and biodiversity through time as well? And almost all of my research in the past in that domain focused on natural regeneration following fire, following harvest and salvage logging, and how we can improve the system. So, yeah, I mean, it's two decades of research that I've been involved with colleagues spanning multiple countries, multiple agencies. I've worked with researchers at the provincial level, at the federal level. We've worked with researchers and academics in the United States and in Europe as well, even Australia. So, yeah, I've gotten around quite a bit. And the field work is the best part, honestly. There's something, you go out to do field work up in James Bay, you know, driving to work in the morning into the woods, and you got your shotgun in the back seat and spot some grouse on the road or whatnot. You know, I was baiting bear on one of the logging roads, and then I was trying to stalk them with my shotgun. And yeah, lots of fun, lots of fun. So I kind of merged the two together, the two passions.
That's awesome. And the reason I brought up like the forestry management is I think that's one thing that people miss when they think about like, or let's say habitat management in general. And DU and Delta do a really good job of promoting like, this is our marsh, we help with this. But I feel like the National Wild Turkey Foundation, Rough Grouse Society, they all have foresters, they have biologists, they're working with the local foresters for the state government and the federal and all of this to make and sustain habitat. And I think that's one thing that gets missed when there's a lot of like there's great outreaches that these do. They have their banquets and they do these learn to hunt events, but there's so much that they've done in the background. And that's why I brought that up, because there's so much more to support here than just what you might see. There's a lot that they do in the background as well to make sure that we have birds and make sure we have habitat for years to follow.
Yeah, absolutely. And also another important thing to keep in mind is that, for example, governments, be it state or provincial governments, you know, they have limited funding for this kind of work. So they have their staff biologists that do this work, but, you know, they're limited in just how much they can do. So by having these not-for-profits that employ their own biologists and run their own research or run research together with federal and state or provincial governments really adds a lot to the picture. And also often, you know, especially with government, their hands are kind of tied because they have special interest groups, right? So they kind of have a narrative that they have to follow. It doesn't necessarily, I'm not implying anything nefarious, but, you know, right. they have different special interest groups. And so they have to cater to those groups and kind of find like a middle ground, whereas conservation organizations, their main goal is conservation, is sustainable management of game species. So their hands aren't as tied with the kind of research they want to implement. You know, for example, under the previous Harper government, a lot of scientists in Canada were muzzled. There, you know, research in certain directions was not being pushed because of the potential political implications. But for organizations like not-for-profits, that really isn't a limiting factor because they're free to do what they want to do, what they think is best to do.
Good.
Makes sense. And it all is to that bigger picture of sustainable habitat, sustainable birds. And so that way they're those that enjoy it and find the value in it. It's there. It's there for generations to come.
Yeah. And it's also about building a powerful lobby as well. You know, you get the hunting community organized, and, you know, a lot of people who support these conservation organizations aren't even hunters. But when you get these people together, You can use that to mobilize people when it comes time to, for example, fight government initiatives that might be detrimental to conservation, or fight special interest groups for pushing narratives that are detrimental, again, to conservation or to a lifestyle that they don't understand, without naming anyone. They know who they are.
Yep. Don't need to get into that one. Yeah. Well, that's been very informative, and I appreciate all the stuff that you've been saying. But like we were talking about, we definitely need to get an episode on actual, like, you know, what do you need, and how do you hunt these birds, and how do you get started, and what's all that stuff. Like, yeah, you're a pretty informative guy, and it's been good.
Yeah, I think we could spend at least another hour on that. Maybe a lot more even.
Yeah.
There's a lot to talk about.
And then we could do a gross episode.
Yeah. Absolutely. We'll keep that turkey theme here, and fire up a turkey episode. But come fall, we could fire off a grouse episode when everyone's getting excited to get back out there, and I'll have a tiny little squish of a dog running around that I get my new puppy in September. So,
what'd you get?
I'm getting another wired hair Griffon.
Nice.
Mine's officially retired. She retired last year, so yeah. Starting with a pup.
Yeah. Fun times.
Well, I appreciate you coming on, and this has been just a wealth of knowledge.
Well, thank you very much for having me. It's been very interesting, and you know, I always try to jump on any opportunity that I get to share this kind of information with people. I think that's one of the keys, is to transmit this kind of knowledge, this kind of information, to as many people as possible, and not just so people could be informed about the decisions they make and their perceptions about hunting, but also to again, have people perhaps become interested in hunting and interested in this whole conservation side of it.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Any final thoughts? Otherwise, we can wrap it up, and we'll be back, and we'll bring you back on, and we'll talk about how to actually hunt turkeys now that people understand what's impacting them.
Awesome. I look forward to it.
Good.
I appreciate you coming on, Dave.
Yeah. Thanks for coming on. I'm looking forward to the next one, but I got a lot to soak up for this one and research, like some of the words you said, like hypotheses or whatever that was. I'm just kidding.
Yeah. To all the listeners out there, I appreciate you tuning in. And until next time, keep chasing that experience.